go. Let's go. This is Perhaps It's You, your absolute 100% favorite Unsolved Mysteries rewatch podcast. I am Liz.
I'm Samantha.
Surprise, surprise. I'm in a bad mood today. And Mac was like, well, talking to Samantha when you record later will cheer you up. And you're like, I was like, you know what? You're right. It will.
Oh, I'm so honored.
It really will, because I'm just not feeling it today, you know?
I don't know. The vibes are off. In our last episode, we talked about the Minnesota Ice Woman, not knowing that we ourselves would become Minnesota Ice Woman in just a few short weeks. It is so cold.
It's January, and I almost couldn't say the word January. It's January in Minnesota. It's fucking cold as hell. I have been sleeping really terribly lately. I have one eye that's just like keeps getting bloodshot.
Oh.
You know how like one of the few my few joys is going to the pool for water aerobics? Lately, every time I go to the pool, one of my eyes is bloodshot.
Oh, like the chlorine is irritating.
It will like get better. I'll go, oh, thank Christ, it's better. It doesn't really hurt. It just like looks insane. And then I'll go, oh, thank Christ, it's better. And then I go back to the pool and it's worse again.
Oh.
I know. It's probably the worst thing that's happening to anyone.
You can't have anything.
That is how I feel, because I am so melodramatic. I was like, this world isn't meant for me. Nothing could go right. I can't sleep. I can't go to the pool. I can't go outside.
So I take it, I don't know if you want to talk about this on the podcast, but you had been trying to give up chocolate in hopes that that would help your sleep. And I know you had mixed feelings about whether or not you wanted that to work. So it did not work.
It did fucking nothing.
Okay,
so
well, I guess I'm glad you can keep eating chocolate, but I'm sad that your sleep has not been improved.
No. Is anybody else Cymbalta gang with me? I take Cymbalta for fibromyalgia, and it's supposed to make people sleepy. I guess it makes most people sleepy. And I think maybe they put something in it to like counteract that. That it has like an alert. I don't know. Whatever. It keeps me the fuck up. And lately it's been not so great. So
I've heard that some even like specific sleep medicines have an opposite effect on some people.
Yes. I also have that with valerian root, which is one of those natural things that's supposed to help you sleep. It's in a lot of sleepy teas, stuff like that. And it turns out that wakes me the fuck up. Which is not fair, because also caffeine, I mean, I feel like I complain about this on every podcast. I don't know why it comes up so often, but I also can't have caffeine, really. So it's like, well, cool. Not the things that put you to sleep. Not the things that wake you up. Just nothing. Nothing for me. Nothing. Okay. So I don't think we have any updates, because we just live in a frozen tundra. And I have the curtains open by the podcasting table right now so I can remember what the sun looks like. I do think it's helping a little bit. I do think it's helping a little bit, even through the window. Oh, goddamn. Okay. I'm done bitching, I think, for one second. Do I go? I go first.
You do.
Because this is, see, okay, this odd number thing, so helpful. Goddamn. Wish we had figured it out before season 8.
You know, we're slow learners, but we do learn.
I think that's the key. You know, it's a journey. We're going to get there. But our last episode of this podcast is going to be polished as fuck. But until then, it's just, you know, two lovely ladies that do not know how to record.
Whatever. You get what you pay for.
For real. For real. Even if you give us a dollar on Patreon, like still. Still.
You get your money's worth. For
best deal on Patreon. I'm still going to root for us that way. Some people are charging $6 an episode, and we're charging $1. Because we are the
unlimited episodes.
Well, we are the home goods of podcasts, everybody. We are the Marshall. We are the fucking deal. We are not the Goodwill, because that place is a ripoff now. We are the fucking home goods of the podcast situation. Sign up for our Patreon, patreon.com/perhapsitsyou. Years ago, it was spelled wrong. That's no longer true. You can find us. You can give us a dollar. I just think it's funny. I just think it's funny that this is a business. We have to file taxes and shit. It's all very funny to me. And I still am like, oh, yeah. Like, oh, yeah, I have a podcast. Like, it's not new information. But for some reason, it seems so unreal that it will never sink in. Also, I think if I fully, like, realized it, I would get freaked out and we would never make this again. Do you know what I mean?
There's a level of denial,
yes.
I think you need to be in always.
If I was like, me, people are probably
not like
No, because it's sometimes late at night, I'll be like, oh my God, there are people in fucking Australia. There are people in fucking Japan listening to my voice and going, she just said that wrong. She just mispronounced that word.
About these things.
Exactly.
I know you're awake in the middle of
exactly.
the night. You have to suppress these thoughts.
And if I really like accepted that, I think I would be like, oh my God, what am I doing making a podcast? I'm not a whatever, entertainer, presenter. The other day, Mac was like, well, you're basically a professional comedian. And I was like, I don't know about that. Stop right now. That's kind, I guess, except that all comedians are like freaks. But if you're a comedian, you're a freak and you know all your friends are freaks. Come on. Please. Please.
I mean, don't you have to be funny? Like, I don't know.
Yes, exactly.
Normal people aren't funny.
Normal, well-adjusted people are not going on stage revealing the deepest, darkest parts of themselves for applause. That's not a healthy behavior.
Not, no.
I remember years ago, David Cross released this like terrible money grab book that was supposed to be funny. It was just like essays. It was like, sometimes you pick up a book and you're like, wow, this took 2 hours. You know what I mean? But you know, Mr. Show was funny. So I flipped out the book and I was like, wow, this is something his agent told him to do. And it's like, he did not have a book in him, right? This is a money grab if I ever saw one. But just like flipping through it, he was talking about how girls who dye their hair bright colors are just like looking for attention or whatever. They think it makes them so interesting. And I was like, bitch.
Very original take.
Bitch, you live for applause. You think you don't want attention? You are a fucking stand-up comedian. What are you talking about? Oh, yeah, you're doing it for the attention? I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were in that fucking Alvin and the Chipmunks movie for the honor. Okay, anyway.
That was serious cinema, Liz.
Yeah. Okay, I know that was to, like, pay the rent, but still, you know, whatever. I don't even know what my point is. I'm just mad. But I actually love my first segment. We're on season 8, episode 11. I start off with an unexplained. We start off fucking strong. This is like my new favorite segment now. Because Robert Stack asks, is there a life beyond this one? And you know that's my favorite kind of mystery.
When Robert Stack is asking those kinds of questions, you know it's going to be good.
Then you lean in. Don't lean in at work. That is bullshit. But when Robert Stack says, is there a life before this one? Go, oh, that should really get your attention. Because he says that 4 in 10 people claim to have had experienced some form of communication with the dead. And this is often through dreams. And these are apparently referred to as direct contacts. Never heard that term before, but okay. We hear about Michelle O'Malley of Portsmouth, Virginia. It was November 15th, 1993, 3 months after the birth of her son, Benjamin. And that night, she had an extraordinary dream that she believes to be direct contact from her deceased grandfather. Now, we get a reenactment of this dream, and it's the fucking funniest thing to me. Because it is like a grainy sepia kitchen that her grandpa is in, and he's just coming up and saying over and over again, did you make that French toast? Did you make that French toast? Did you make that French toast? And if I was the one telling the story, I think I would have left this dream out.
Yeah, it's not the...
It doesn't... We never learn if there's, like, some special connection to French toast. Did her grandfather used to make her French toast? Did, like, she eat French toast every year on her birthday or something? Like, it's just...
If that existed, she would have mentioned it.
It's just a fucking random-ass dream, like we all have, where you wake up and you go, what the fuck was that?
Yeah, it doesn't seem to be much significance other than her grandfather's in it.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's the first dream, and I love it. Also, Michelle. Okay, Michelle. Style icon. Her hair
is so big.
So big. And I cannot believe that is not a wig. But I looked real close, and wig technology is not what it is today back in 1993. I really think this is her real hair teased to the gods. And the fact that you could get that much volume...
Honestly impressive.
Just some fucking Aquanet and a comb. Like, what an artiste.
Have you seen the Long Island Medium lately?
Yes. There's no way that's
not Long Island Medium size, but it's getting there.
I learned that Aquanet was invented in St. Paul on that ghost tour that we took.
Oh, fascinating. A true legacy. Minnesota yes. Brought to the world, Aquanet.
Yes, I saw a meme the other day that was pictures of women that had like very bouffant hair, like Brigitte Bardot, or you know, maybe something like Michelle. And it was like, you know, real talk, why did white women stop wearing their hair like this? And someone was like, no joke, the ozone layer. And that is
I've seen that meme. It's true.
100% true. Yes, because those aerosols were causing we used so much Aquanet to make these beautiful hairstyles that they caused damage to the ozone layer around the earth. But what's so fascinating about that to me is that, you know, people learned that, they stopped, and the ozone layer has improved. And I think the only reason we don't talk about that more is because it sort of suggests we should do something about global warming, but we're just like not gonna, you know?
Right, because we like our insert whatever product here.
Right.
And plastics, I don't know.
And maybe I should take this opportunity to apologize to my mom, because I would, as a child, I was very concerned about the ozone layer, and I nagged her like nobody's business about using aerosols. But another way, it's like, mom, you're welcome. We saved the earth.
We did it.
Congratulations to all of us. I don't know if my family still uses that pump thing for the olive oil, so that we weren't using the PAM spray, but that was because of my constant nagging.
I remember being very concerned about the ozone layer in sort of the same way I was concerned about the Bermuda Triangle and quicksand. And it was, you know,
I was very worried about the rainforest. That has only gotten worse, but the ozone layer did get better.
You know what? Silver linings.
Okay, so anyway, Michelle's an icon. She was only 10 when her grandfather died, and her son was named after him. They were both named Benjamin. So days later, she had a second dream, and this one had a message for her dad, Greg, in which her grandfather told Greg to fetch a pail of water and meet him at the railroad tracks. And Michelle woke up and was like, that doesn't make any goddamn sense. That's like that French toast thing. But when she told her dad, he was like, oh, that's because back when I was a kid, this one Labor Day, we went fishing by the railroad tracks and we caught eels we found under rocks and put them in a pail of water.
That's so specific.
And Michelle had never heard this story, apparently, for it to just be like lingering in her subconscious or whatever. This was news to her. So over time, the dreams became more and more real. Sometimes she would appear in the dreams speaking with her grandfather. Sometimes it was just her grandfather almost like talking to camera at her. We see a reenactment of him, like, it's like him and her over her son's crib, like watching the baby sleep. And he's like, I'm so glad that you named your son Benjamin after me. And he also asked if she could locate her uncle's Purple Heart war medal. And at first, she calls her dad and she was like, okay, is this like the bucket of water? I don't know anything about a Purple Heart. And he was like, I don't either. That must not be correct. I'm not aware of anyone having a Purple Heart. But then he talked to his mom, and it turns out that one of his uncles did have one, and his mom had it, and it was wrapped in a flag, just like apparently the grandfather said it would be. So not only did Michelle not know.
It's wild that they didn't know about it, but he came to them in a dream and told them.
Yeah, it's spooky. Okay. And then this is my favorite one, maybe more than the French toast, I'm not sure. But she had a dream that she's like following her grandfather through the woods. Her grandfather is like walking too fast and talking to someone, and she's trying to catch up and she can't keep up with him. And eventually her grandfather turns around and is like, look, I gotta go. I can't be waiting around these woods for you. I got shit to do. But tell Greg that I've got his lucky pencil. And he holds up a pencil. And then him and his friend are gone in the woods. And she wakes up and is again like, what the fuck? She calls her dad. And he's like, oh, so my mom had this box of like used stubby pencils. This is so funny to me. In the garage. And I took them down to the horse track and sold them as, quote, lucky pencils.
A little entrepreneur.
To degenerate gamblers who bought them. It's a scam, but it's so good. It took nothing. He just spun that straw into gold. I really hate an entrepreneurial adult, but an entrepreneurial child.
Oh, there's nothing better.
So charming. Okay. Anyway.
To sell lucky pencils lucky to pencil. Gamblers is so funny.
It's like, yeah, it's almost used up because it's lucky. Not because it's crap and it's about to be thrown away. It's like, oh yeah, I need this. Okay. Brilliant scam. I love it so much. I guess he spent a lot of time at the racetrack, and so the racetrack was in the dreams a lot, to the point where she was like even meeting like friends of his and like, you know, distant relatives, like, and shit, like, oh, no, you
stands, wait to her?
Yeah, where they'd be like, oh, don't you know me, old Uncle Bob or whatever? And she's like, no, what? But it turns out all those people she would meet in the dreams are real. Crazy. He also told Michelle that he would always watch over her and Benjamin. Over 2 years, she had, which is like, they started and then there's 2 years to record the segment. So I don't know if they kept going after that or what. But she had over 100 dreams that she believes were direct contacts from her deceased grandfather. And that she goes to sleep looking forward to each encounter.
Amazing. Amazing. It's
totally amazing. I know there's this idea that like talking about dreams is really boring and no one wants to hear about your dreams. I totally disagree. I always want to hear about dreams because it's just, we don't even really understand what they are. Like to some degree, it's your brain processing information or it's your brain. We don't really know what the fuck. And that's interesting to me. And this is interesting to me.
And the level of specificity and the fact that she never knew these things. And in some cases, you know, her father didn't know about it either. To me, that lends some serious credibility to this.
I just think it's a cool story. And I do not get the French toast thing, but children, if you find a bunch of almost used up pencils, now you know what to do.
You've got some ideas.
You can sell them as lucky pencils at the racetrack. Yeah, I love this segment. For this segment, 5 out of 5 for Robert Stacks.
I thought it was great.
Okay, now it's your turn to talk about a very big case.
So the next segment is covering an infamous case. This is the Green River Killing. And it's basically falsely accusing someone of this murder. So
I have to admit, I did not pay close attention to this segment because once it got going, I realized that they were talking about the totally wrong person.
I mean, yeah, this is, because you would think this would be an exciting segment because it's about a very famous serial killer.
They're totally just accusing some dude who now we know is not the murderer. So it just like sucks to be that guy, I guess. Look,
yeah, his brother comes on the show to basically be like, he's fucking lying. He did it. So
I wouldn't be surprised if he's a different type of creep. I'm sure he was up to
something. He wasn't the Green River Killer.
Nefarious, but it is not this. So, like, I mean, I guess he was already dead. I was like, imagine going on TV and being like, oh, it is my brother. And then it is not.
I mean, I guess all we can hope for is maybe, like, he had this coming because he was a creep in other ways. But
yeah. Yeah, well,
you know. I don't know. Yeah, sucks to be this guy. So, I forget how Robert Stack opens the segment. It's something like he's standing on the banks of the Green River, and I didn't write it down. Oh, well. Anyway, it's a very good, like, establishing shot of Robert Stack. And it kind of makes you, like, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a really interesting true crime story. And it's not. But, I mean, it is, but not this segment. So it was one of the largest serial murder cases in U.S. history. 2 years, 48 victims, all young women. Most of them were sex workers who operated along the SeaTac strip near the Seattle-Tacoma airport. Nearly all of them were strangled and dumped in a remote area. Thousands of leads were investigated, hundreds of suspects interrogated, and we're told that one suspect stood out, William J. Stevens.
It's not him. It's not him.
It sure ain't. Bill Stevens was a petty thief, in and out of trouble with the law for most of his life. In 1981, he simply walked away from a minimum security facility where he was serving time for burglary. Mm-hmm. Over the next 8 years, Stevens avoided arrest, dividing his time in the cities of Seattle, Spokane, and Portland. According to Roderick Thorpe, an author who has written extensively on the Green River murders, Stevens was an alienated individual who never held a job. I'm not sure why that would make him a serial murderer of almost 50 people, but let's see what he has to say.
Samantha, if that guy had had a paper route, if he had, like, worked at Dairy Queen, he wouldn't have killed all those people. Except that he didn't. Except that it's not him!
So the reason they think it's him, and this what is his name? What is the author's name? Thorpe. Roderick Thorpe says he, quote, fit all the FBI profiles of serial killers, which is basically that he hated women. He had mommy issues.
He's a white dude. age is, what is it, like 25 to 45 or something. Isolated, a loner, mean to animals, head injury. like, so many people fall within that.
So many people, and many, if not, you know, I'm going to say most of them are not serial murderers. But really,
you know, we'll cut white guys a little bit of slack. Okay, we've all been very hard on you lately. I know it's so tough. So we are going to be, perhaps it's you, is going to come out, and we are going to make a pro men statement that most of y'all are not serial killers. Okay. Thank you.
This might be the only pro men statement we've
I hope that makes up for the Barbie movie and whatever other grievances you have.
Yeah, us saying we should send you all to the moon.
You'll love it there. That was nice.
So,
you're going to love that moon colony. There's cheese up there. There's as much cheese as you could eat.
Look, we're going to put Elon Musk in charge of making the moon colony.
Yeah.
You all love him, so...
If you don't, you don't have to go. How about that?
Okay. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
That's
fair. If you don't want to follow Elon Musk to the literal ends of the earth, then you don't have to.
Okay. I think that's fair. Now, we may have sent Bill Stevens to the moon colony. He did hate women. He was convinced that the sex workers on the SeaTac Strip were spreading AIDS. And he would like frequently say very horrible things about them and maybe about women in general.
It's interesting how people who, and this is true with just hating stuff, but like if you seriously hate sex workers, I don't know, don't hire any. Problem solved. Like you don't need to really think about it. You know what I mean?
You don't. It really doesn't affect you at all.
Yeah. Why is he like so focused on this? Like, oh, I hate that people pay for sex. And it's like, well, dude, like, just don't do that then.
What are you doing with your free time, Bill Stevens?
Yeah, it's like I don't like football, so I don't watch it. You know, it's right. Like really
you're
easy
not for protesting me. Outside of stadiums.
Maybe I'll start though.
I mean, there's worse things to protest. Bob Stevens,
but but if I do protest, I'm getting that NFL Rob Lowe hat though.
Absolutely,
it's gonna confuse the message, but I'm doing it anyway.
If you know, you know.
Yeah.
Bob Stevens, Bill's adopted brother, claimed his brother told several people how he wanted to murder women. According to Bob, Bill
just
said,
casual Friday night conversation. It's like, oh, should we see a movie? Should we go bowling? And he's like, you know what I'd love to do? Murder some broads. And everybody's like, that's really weird. We're going to karaoke. We're not doing that.
It's not my idea of a good time.
Yeah, they're like, that sounds really messy and like the stress. No, thank you. Like, we're going to Applebee's.
So, yes, Bob Stevens went on national TV to accuse his adoptive brother of being a serial murderer of almost 50 people. But I will cut him some slack because allegedly Bill Stevens did say to multiple people that he wanted to cut up women, to dissect them, and to fill them with rocks.
Yeah, it's very disturbing behavior. Look, if this guy wouldn't be, I'm not saying that he did this, but I wouldn't be surprised if, I don't know, he's a rapist or he's just a violent individual in general.
Abuser. This is a red flag.
Yeah, it's very, very odd. Please no. Please get some help.
Sort of does seem like the only evidence, though, that the people who accuse him of being the Green River Killer is that he lived in the area and he hated women. And I just think that's not strong evidence.
It's not
great character evidence. I mean, it's not a guy I want to be friends with. And I don't really like the fact that I'm like having to be in a position of defending him, but like it isn't evidence of murder.
Yeah, it's not. You can't bring that to court. You can't be like, look,
I mean,
this
good. I don't know if it would hold up in front of a jury. I would hope not.
This guy was like around and also he sucks. Like that's that he had opportunity and check out his personality. It's not good. But I'm betting he did something, but it's not this. You know?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if I found out that he did something, but it was not murder 48 sex workers.
He's the red herring. He is the, like,
yeah.
Law and Order has wrapped up who it is, but either you look at the clock and you're like, oh God, we're only 28 minutes in. There's no way. There's no way that guy's the killer. That's him.
It's true. It is true. So acting on several tips, police searched the house in Spokane where Stevens lived with his parents. They uncovered a cache of guns and police badges. They also found dozens of Polaroids of nude women, most of them sex workers.
Huh. Interesting. Huh, that's interesting. Maybe you could just, I don't know, leave them alone. If you hate them so fucking much.
It's probably self-loathe, right? Like,
no, I mean, that's my point. Yes. Obviously, he's like, I don't know, battling his own stupid demons. Because a normal person would be like, oh, I don't approve of that. And therefore, I'm not going. Like,
yeah, exactly. But of course, it's their fault that he goes to them.
Look, women shouldn't be so hot, okay? That's what, like, so much things really boil down to when you get down to it is, like, I find women attractive. Grr. And it's like, I'm sorry you're straight? I don't know.
Yeah.
Some of us are straight, and it's not great, but that's just the way it worked out.
It's just the cards we were dealt, all right? In another room, police discovered dozens of pornographic tapes and fraudulent credit card receipts from 1981 to 1989, which were the years that the Green River killer was
why
acting.
Is he keeping these fraudulent credit card receipts? Buy a shredder. A fire pit.
Look, maybe this guy was not the brightest. Investigators later searched a second house in Portland where Stevens had lived until 1985. According to Roderick Thorpe, the basement held a secret room which could only be accessed by using a garage door opener.
Okay, be honest. How much did you want this secret room?
A lot. I would love to have a secret room.
Same. And Mac was walking through the room as I was watching this, and he was like, that kicks ass. I was like, well, it made them think this guy was a murderer. But on the other hand, it is very cool.
Yeah. Secret rooms are objectively cool as long as they're not being used for
the murder. Like, I don't know if this was the real one or they built another one, but essentially you like push the garage door button and the entire bookcase just like elegantly turned. You didn't have to like push it or anything. And then you can go into the, I want it so bad. It's so fucking cool.
And, you know, again, having a secret room is not evidence that you're like, you could just want a cool secret room.
Yeah. And also this guy clearly had his own, you know, sexual demons or whatever you want to call it. So he maybe just needed like a weird sex room.
Yeah. And he had to have a place to hide his Polaroids of nude women. I don't know.
He should have gotten, have you watched that Netflix show How to Build a Sex Room where this like sassy English woman comes and like it's actually really fun.
It's literally called How to Build a Sex Room.
How to Build a Sex Room.
Is this HGTV After Dark or what?
Basically, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I'm into it.
This sassy English woman comes to your house and you're like, oh, like me and my wife want to like spice up our bedroom or whatever. And she just like does a makeover of the room, but it's like a sexy makeover. And then it's like people, different couples are like into different stuff, and she like incorporates that in the room makeover.
She needs to do one where it's a perfectly normal room, like grayish, millennial gray.
I think she did one with a secret door, is why. And I'm then thinking
you push in a book on the bookcase, yeah. And it's like, you know, the red room or whatever the fuck yeah. These things look like.
But I just feel like if he had a like more plush kind of boudoir set up in there, he wouldn't have gotten accused of murder so easily. If he had some like, you know, like nice fabrics and textures.
Yeah.
Instead of just this like concrete bunker with a bed. No vibe. He needed vibes.
Right. It's like the subreddit male living spaces.
Oh, God. I was obsessed with that for a while. And it's dark.
It's bad. It's bad. This is a room that would be on that subreddit, and this is why you can't be designing rooms like that, fellas. You need
women will come over and then later accuse you of being a murderer, which is what happened here. This was like his neighbor that he was like, "Oh, let me show you something cool." She came over, saw this, and was like, "Ha ha ha ha," and left. Right, and now he's like telling the police their unsolved mysteries. Like, yeah, something's up with that dude.
If just get some peel and stick wallpaper, get some warm, soft lighting.
If you are hanging up a flag, you better fucking iron it.
Well, getting back, yet,
don't.
Don't.
Unless it's the new Minnesota flag and you want
that one's fine.
That you embrace change. That's okay.
That one's fine. That one's fine. But steam it.
Steam it for sure. Getting back to the idea that women are too attractive and it's, you know, so sad. I am really tired of hearing that men are visual creatures as an excuse for poor behavior, as if I haven't seen how y'all live. I'm supposed to believe men are visual creatures, but put a mattress on the ground and just have wires connected to everything and fucking milk crates and shit. No real furniture.
It's just like an empty room with a folding chair in front of a TV on the floor.
A Swedish prison is better decorated than a single man's apartment. And I'm supposed to believe that you're like so visually okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that adds up. That makes sense.
Just, fellas, just get on Pinterest. It's not even that hard. Just copy something you see.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that hard. Really not. It's really not. Just it's like not. Fucking go to a Crate and Barrel for once in your goddamn life without a woman making you. That's the advice here on this podcast. Pottery so Barn. Ever heard of it?
Walk into a. You are not going to get smited. Like you are a sinner in church if you step foot in a Pottery Barn.
It's okay to be straight and go to the Pottery Barn. I want to get that word out there.
Spread the word.
If you want to continue,
you'll get more pussy.
Yeah, yes. If you want some panties to drop, this is how you will behave. And you will stop telling me how visual you are just because you like boobs. That's not the same thing.
I realize there's no one listening to this podcast that actually needs this advice, but we are giving out excellent advice for free.
I still live to give it. I still live to give it, and I want absolutely nothing. I want no commentary and response. I just want to send it out into the universe, give myself a thumbs up for a good job, and go about my day.
This is public service is what we're doing right here.
You know how they used to have those ads? I think it was NBC that would be like, the more you know, and the star would come over.
Yes.
Well, celebrities could do, like, that could be public fucking service for them. Like, they would get a DUI. Walking
into a Pottery Barn won't make you gay.
Yeah. So that's, this is our public service.
And if it did, I would be there so fast.
Yeah, that sounds great.
People are camping outside of a Pottery Barn.
If walking into the Pottery Barn made you gay, the Pottery Barn would be better. Like, it would be a better store. It would have better shit. So that's clearly not true.
Yeah.
I just proved it.
You're welcome. So I think you mentioned this, but the secret room first came to the attention of a neighbor who lived outside of Portland at the same time Stevens did. He invited her in to see this room. And as Liz said, she stepped foot in it and went, creepy shit happens in here. No thanks.
He really misplayed that hand, you know? And it's good. It's good because she saw a red flag and she, you know, ran for the hills.
I mean, this is why this decorating style is not going to get you any pussy, guys. Because basically all that was in this room was a mattress with a mannequin on it.
A mannequin in like a sex pose. This is why you do this behavior, you end up with your brother accusing you of murder on Unsolved Mysteries. There's
you
a, direct
have a secret
line
with a mattress on the floor and a mannequin dressed in women's underwear in a quote obscene pose. And you brought a woman into this room.
This poor woman. You know her whole life flashed before her eyes. And she was like, yeah, oh my god, I just want to see my family again.
She's like, I'm never leaving this room.
Let me out of this basement right now.
She ran for the hills.
She's like, oh, I could really use a drink of water. Okay, bye. She's already like running up.
Fucking terrifying.
Poor woman.
Because
you
have
normal
behavior.
That is. Okay, remember we talked about that story with the fucking box over the head?
Oh, God. Yes. What was that called? The scream box? I forget. It was horrible.
If I was led into a basement and shown this room, the next thing I would think was, oh, my head's going to be inside that scream box.
Yep.
I'm never going to see daylight again.
That's logically where your thoughts will go.
I'm going to end up at Baraska.
Fast forward to your brother on Unsolved Mysteries saying things just don't add up here.
This guy must have been so creepy. This guy must have been so creepy. For his own brother to be like this guy. It's not. I can't get over it.
So in January of 1989, Bill Stevens was arrested and charged with felony escape and a series of weapons violations. That summer, he was also publicly named as a prime suspect in the Green River killings.
So how is that even a thing? That sounds like a lawsuit waiting to happen. I clearly I don't understand the law. I just watch TV. But to be like, you know who we think did it? This guy. And that guy's just like, what the fuck?
Well, and I think they get away with it because, like, you know, it's a suspect, it's a person of interest, whatever, you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. If this was yeah. a, I mean,
it he seems was... like defamation to me, is it not? I guess not.
I don't know. If you're just saying that they're suspected of it, I mean, that is true.
Right, right.
They're not saying he did it. I think they, you know, so I think that's probably how you get past that.
Yeah,
and there's probably also some other laws like written in that, like, I don't know, the cops can't defame you. I don't know.
Sure.
What do I know?
Lawyers, let us know. Let me know why that's not defamation. I am curious.
Perhaps as you podcast at gmail.com. Mm-hmm. Within months, however, authorities had cleared Stevens based on an alibi provided by his younger brother, Bob. So the very Bob who is on Unsolved Mysteries accusing him of being the Green River Killer, not like flat out accusing him, but basically being like, I think something's weird here. He had visited him in King County Jail before he was transferred to Spokane, and he mentioned that he couldn't have done the killings because he was on a trip in Connecticut visiting Bob in 1982 when the killings first happened, which was true. And so based on that alibi and the fact that there was like no other evidence, the police decided he could not have done that.
Yeah, what were they going to prosecute him with? There is not, there just like bad vibes. He's a creep.
Yeah, he was just in the area, but like not for all the killings. After the 1982 visit, Bill Stevens joined his parents on a cross-country trip, and Bob produced receipts which seemed to prove that his brother was still traveling with their parents when the first five victims were murdered.
I also love these reenactment shots of him like traveling with his parents, and they try to make it seem so sinister. He went on vacation in a car.
Well,
and
Bob,
sometimes it was night out and you couldn't like see that good.
Bob claims basically that he was on this trip with his parents to like fabricate an alibi, and it's like very confusing. It's not like clear why he thinks that, because he like very clearly was not there during five of the murders.
He thinks his brother would like go on this trip secretly, like go back to home to commit murders, and then like sneak back with his parents to make it look like he was there the whole time. But I actually think that would be pretty hard to do.
Yeah, I think so. And also his parents were like, no, he was with us the whole time.
I think they would know if he was routinely, and maybe they would lie to cover him. That's understandable.
48, he murdered 48 people. That is so much. He's like, I gotta leave again. They're like, what are you doing? Why are you leaving our vacation?
Like 24 hours at a time. And yeah, it's just, wouldn't there be travel records? Wouldn't there be like,
there
some
would be.
Indication.
That's basically what the police say on the show. They're like, there is no evidence that he was doing the things that Bob says he was doing.
I really like the one cop is like, this is all news to me. And also,
he does. He says that. He was like, if that's what Bob thinks, he's never told us.
Sounds like someone wants to be on TV.
Yeah. But Bob says, quote, I really believe my brother is the Green River Killer. The police had the killer behind bars in 1989, and I helped get the killer off free.
No, you didn't.
No, you just said facts. I don't. If that those facts exonerate him, then he's not the Green River Killer. I'm sorry. Yeah. So yeah, Bob questions whether his brother was actually with his parents when the murders happened. The authorities didn't even re-interview Bob or William for the Green River murders. Roderick Thorpe believes that this was the case because Stevens was a police informant. This is what author Roger Thorpe claims with zero evidence. The police are involved in misdirection here because they don't want the public looking too closely at the various roles Stevens played in his life. Police are only as good as the information they get from the people who live as Stevens did on the edge of society. A guy like Stevens is constantly giving them information about more serious criminals, but at the same time he was indulging in his own little sport, which is the murder of young girls. He has no evidence that Bill Stevens was a police informant. He's I cannot emphasize this enough. Based on what we see in the episode, he's making this up. There's no evidence that he was a police informant.
This guy really should have become a mystery novelist because he can spin quite a yarn.
He can. I'll give him that. But the police who are on the show are like, he wasn't an informant. And if he was, we wouldn't let him get away with murder because that is the highest crime. Like, what are you talking about?
They're like, okay, look, he did murder 48 fucking people, but he helped us get that pot dealer one town over. So it's like, he is the criminal they would want to get. So that doesn't make any sense.
It makes even Thorpe's own explanation of him, it doesn't make sense. So Bill Stevens, as we mentioned earlier, died of cancer in 1991, but critics of the investigation still insist that he could have been the serial killer. Roger Thorpe even proposed a theory that suggested others may have been involved. I think you're right. I think Roderick needs to get into fiction writing because he's making stuff up here.
I think Roderick might actually be a writer. Let me check. Oh, and I also did name his mustache. Roderick's mustache is huge. It's like unsightly. And it's called the Big Selick. There's also a Detective Tom. He had a mustache that was called the Golden Gate Bridge. I might have said that before, but you can perfectly. Yeah, okay. This guy literally did write police and crime novels. So he's just spinning a tale.
Making stuff up. Because he claims at the very end of this that Stevens wasn't working alone, that his phone bills were in the possession of a police, and one of the detectives told him that they were puzzled by the hours of long distance calls to a certain number. And then the police officer who was being interviewed basically says that long phone calls to friends is not evidence of murder.
He actually wrote a novel called River, a novel of the Green River Killings in 1995. Okay. he died in 1999, so he won't be getting
on Unsolved Mysteries.
Acting like that's true. No, I feel like
these things are true when he's just making them. The guy had long phone calls. So did everybody else. That's not evidence that he was the murderer or that he had some
accomplice. People used to talk on the phone so much. I don't think we even really remember how much people used to talk on the phone, myself included, back in the pre-internet times.
Yeah, that is true. I do think Roderick Thorpe should have known this at the time he was on Unsolved Mysteries, saying that.
Well, yes. I love that his author photo is like him in a denim jacket with like an unbuttoned shirt so you can see the chest hairs.
Well, you gotta let that chest hair out.
And he's just like staring daggers. What is this? Okay, I'm not a Robert Thorpe fan, everybody.
We don't say. So obviously we know now that the real Green River Killer, as confirmed by DNA, was Gary Ridgway.
Who also pled and confessed.
He confessed to it. So he was also an early suspect in the Green River Killings. Unsolved Mysteries tells us at the very end that an update that the lab matched his DNA evidence found with a number of the victims. He eventually pled guilty to murdering 48 women. In exchange for the plea, he was given life without the possibility of parole. And we're told that despite the evidence, Bob Stevens still insists his brother Bill was somehow involved.
Look, he just hated
There's
his
nothing
brother.
That connects Bill, to my knowledge, there's nothing that connects Gary Ridgway to Bill Stevens.
Look, that's a pretty big fuck up, and I guess he just didn't want to admit he was wrong.
Yeah, I suppose.
Have you ever had Green River soda?
No.
It's like a lime soda. I was just looking it up. I guess it's like a Midwest thing. It started in 1919. But anyway, I would just always think, like, man, the people that made Green River Soda must have been pretty fucking pissed.
And I would say so. That's the first thing I think of when I hear Green River Soda. I'm like, oh, that's not really appetizing.
Yeah. I mean, and they're like, but we had our soda first. It's not fair this killer came along. Anyway, I could really go for a bottle of that right now. It sounds super refreshing. Oh, yeah. So
okay, we have a lost love next that made me cry.
Yeah, this is really fucking sad. Okay, so back in February of 1967, Jean Warren and her family were experiencing heartbreak. 5-year-old Roger Lindsay had been living with the Warrens as a foster child, and he was now leaving. They wanted to adopt him, but that was not allowed. At the time this segment was filmed, it had been 30 years since Jean had said goodbye to Roger, but she had never forgotten him. They met in 1964. At the time, Jean, her husband, and their 3 young daughters were living in Queens, New York. Jean herself was a foster child and had always wanted to do the same for somebody else, which I think is just very sweet and noble and wonderful. So Roger was quickly welcomed as part of the family. Her youngest daughter, Donna, was only a year older than Roger. So they really quickly bonded and, you know, they just did everything together and they treated him as one of the Warrens. Unfortunately, after 3 years together, the Warren family had to move to Ohio. It's not specified why, but I got the impression that was like for work reasons.
Yeah, they had no choice.
Yeah. So they were devastated to discover that Roger could not join them. He still had family connections, which made him ineligible for adoption, and he could not be taken out of state. So he was placed with a new temporary foster family. They couldn't even find a permanent home for him, which just, I think, rubbed extra salt in the wound for Jean, who didn't want to leave him in the first place. It's very sad. The system really failed that child, I feel like. But the update is good, at least, that on the night of the story, Roger was watching and he rushed to call the woman he still calls mom, is what they said. And I just Roger was also reunited with his brother, James. They didn't specify, but I assume that's his biological brother, who he had not seen in nearly 30 years. And the following week, Roger and James also located their dad because of the segment. So that's really sweet. It makes me wish, like, fuck, I wish Unsolved Mysteries had covered this first.
I know.
Why did you cover this season 8? They could have had more years together.
I know.
Okay, I guess they're probably, I don't want to look this up because they're probably dead, but.
Yeah. We don't get a reunion, but we do get a photo of Roger hugging his mother, which is really sweet. It broke my heart because they did try and keep him. They tried to work with the agency to adopt him.
They really wanted it to, but it makes sense. Like, the family has not officially severed ties with Roger, right? Like, so
And we don't find out what happened, like, after. So he went to a foster home, but like, he could have been reunified with his family later on. We don't know anything about them. So I don't know.
So it's all the updates on Unsolved Mystery Wiki says is that, yeah, he did receive a call from his biological brother, James. They had been separated as infants and had not seen each other in almost 30 years. He was reunited with the Warrens at their home in Ohio. Soon after, him and his brother were reunited. And then they were also reunited with an older brother, Philip. I'm not even sure he knew existed. And then his father, Philip Sr., and the rest of that family. Sadly, Jean passed away in May 2018. But at least that gave them some time together. She loved him so much. And she would have done anything for that boy.
Of him saying goodbye, them saying goodbye to him and him getting in the car and waving broke my heart.
He's like reaching out like, I don't want to go. Like,
it was a horrible, it was so sad. And Donna, they were so close in age and they were such good friends. And she said he was her little buddy. She helped him learn how to tie his shoes. He had, I don't know if it was a learning disability or just his circumstance, but he had trouble with, you know, he had some difficulties picking up language. He was a little behind and they worked really hard with him. They said during that whole like 3 years they had with him and he was catching up and doing really well. And then when the foster home woman came to pick him up, she said that the only place they could find for him was a family that didn't speak any English and he only spoke English.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, well, that's not really helpful for this kid who, you know, needs to be unfortunate.
Yeah, it's not great. I really feel like this is the best deed that Unsolved Mysteries did, was reuniting these people.
I agree,
because it's so sweet. And but just the decades of pain she experienced missing this kid, and like, there has to be, okay, I understand that they couldn't adopt him. I understand they couldn't bring him out of the state. Isn't there some way that they should still be able to like communicate with him after he's like bonded? But you know, like,
you would think. I mean, he called her mom for his entire life. The trauma of being, you know, separated from your biological family and then separated from this family, like, just, I can't imagine.
Separated from the only people who love you.
Yeah, who loved you for 3 years and cared for you like their own.
I know.
Yeah. Horrible. The next one is also horrible.
Yeah, brace yourself.
So this is an unexplained death. This is the case of Martha Moxley, who was 15 years old when she was murdered in a gated community in Connecticut. On the night of October 30th, 1975, in the upscale community of Greenwich, Connecticut, 15-year-old Martha Moxley and several friends went out for an evening of teenage pranks.
Did you go out ever go out for an evening of teenage pranks, Samantha?
I didn't, but I was a goody two shoes horse girl, so
the prank was loving your horse so much. Yeah.
The funniest prank of all.
Yeah, my prank was X-Files trivia, I think.
Early the next afternoon, Martha's body was discovered in her own backyard. It appeared she had been bludgeoned to death. Her jeans and underwear were pulled down around her knees, but according to Jack Solomon, Easton, Connecticut's chief of police, there was no evidence of sexual assault.
Okay.
So she had been struck with a golf club in the head. The head of the golf club was found 50 feet from the portion of her driveway where police believed she was accosted. It's believed that the portion of the shaft of the golf club that was used was later used as a weapon to stab her with.
Huh. If you kill me with a golf club, I'm gonna be so pissed.
You're gonna haunt your ass.
Yes, please. No.
No, that's...
I hate golf.
Why this would be the weapon of choice? I just don't under... Oh, God.
It was there, I assume.
I can't imagine any other reason.
Or it's a golfer on a murderous rampage.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
My worst nightmare.
Initially, everyone assumed that Martha's murder had to have been someone from outside the area. However, the broken golf club found at the scene led investigators to a prominent local family. I didn't mention this, but she's found by one of her friends who is like, so she's missing. People are like wondering where she is. And this friend is walking to Martha's house. And as she's cutting through the backyard, she is the one that finds Martha's body and has to like run up to the house. And she's hysterical, terrible, of course. And Martha's mom is like, what? Like, tell me what happened. And she's like, I found Martha. And obviously, mom is excited, but apprehensive because of how upset she is, and she has to say, I don't think she's alive. It's just like the most traumatizing thing imaginable.
Yeah, it's awful.
So that's terrible. Anyway, the club turned out to be part of a set belonging to the Skakel family. The Skakels lived across the street from the Moxleys. 15-year-old Michael Skakel told police he had been with Martha that night. 17-year-old Thomas Skakel was with her as well. Michael told police that at 9:30, he went with his two eldest brothers, John and Rush Jr., to give their cousin a ride home. Meanwhile, Thomas claimed he went home by 9:30 to do a report on Abraham Lincoln.
Okay. I have to say, that's pretty believable. That's a believable alibi. It's like, yeah, teachers do be making you do a lot of reports about Abraham Lincoln.
It's true. Check. Unfortunately, it was a lie.
No!
The police estimated that Martha had been murdered between 9:45 and 10 p.m. But if Michael was in the car and Thomas was in his room, what happened to Martha Moxley in her short walk home? Investigators found yet another suspect in the Skakel household, 24-year-old Kenneth Littleton. He had been hired as a live-in tutor for the Skakel children. He told police that he heard noises outside the house sometime between 9:30 and 10 p.m. Before he went outside, Littleton said he checked on the seven Skakel children.
Oh my God, there were seven of them?
There were seven kids in this house. And Whoa. This guy who was a live-in tutor.
Each a potential murderer.
I don't know how old all of these kids are. We're not told about all of them. Some of them may have been too young to murder. I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know.
So you say, Samantha.
According to Detective Solomon, Littleton claimed that the four oldest boys, including Michael and Thomas, were not at home. And remember, this is between 9:30 and 10 when Thomas claimed he was at home doing a book report on Abraham Lincoln. So someone's not telling the truth. Well, this is a quote. Well, his story was that he's heard some noises coming from the bushes on the property, which like leaves rustling, but he claimed he did not see anything at the time he was out. So he heard something, someone rustling in the bushes. He went out there, but he didn't see anything. And also, four of the boys were not home. Littleton says he didn't see Thomas until 10:25 when Thomas joined him in front of the TV. The other Skate Club boys came home within half an hour, so sometime between 10:25, 10:30, and 11. Over the next several months, detectives interviewed more than 200 people and gave several polygraph tests. According to police, Thomas Skate Club was given two tests. The first was inconclusive, but he passed the second. Which is meaningless, but whatever.
Yeah, that's garbage.
Then, after months of cooperating with authorities, the Skakels, on the advice of their attorney, refused to answer any more questions.
Honestly, fair.
Is smart. Donald Brown, I think, is the guy that we see from the state's attorney's office. And he says that, like, it's not illegal to not talk to the police. Like, it's you have a right to, but, like, most people who are innocent do. And I'm like, man, dude.
Shut up.
Yeah.
That's my advice. Shut up.
Yeah, exactly. And also, they had been cooperating, but it seems like they became like clearer and clearer that you were pretty sure one of their kids killed this girl. And so, of course, their attorney is going to tell them not to talk to you anymore. I'm sorry. It's just...
Okay, even if you are helpful, innocent people, general advice, you should not be fucking talking to the cops ever. But I could see how you, like, after a while, are like, okay, that's enough. Like, right. How much time are you going to really put into this? Like,
no, it's true.
Do you really want the police talking to your children? They fucking railroad people all the time. So,
yeah, no, it's good advice. And it came from their attorney. So you can't really blame the family. They're going to listen to their attorney. Eventually, attention shifted to Kenneth Littleton, who had been initially dismissed by the Skakels, after 6 months. According to police, he was given a polygraph test regarding the Moxley murder, and he failed. Still, authorities felt there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest. Yeah, because polygraphs
that's are not admissible in court, that's not
so you need something else, and it doesn't sound like they had anything. The case became inactive, but 16 years later, at the rape trial of William Kennedy Smith.
Oh, shit.
The Moxley case unexpectedly got new life. So the connection between the Skakel and Kennedy families served as a catalyst. Within weeks, Detective Solomon and the Greenwich police reopened their investigation. We hear from, I think, the same detective who says the opinion of most of the investigators who are trained police officers is that whoever was responsible for this crime probably was in the Skakel home at some point that evening.
I mean, it just makes sense.
Yes. So this is interesting. In 1991, the police brought in the well-known forensic pathologist, Dr. Henry Lee. If you recognize that name, it's probably because Lee was involved in the O.J. Simpson trial. Dr. Lee was able to utilize technology that was unavailable in 1975. Among the items examined by Dr. Lee were clothes found discarded in the Skakels' garage shortly after the murder. He says that he found hair and fiber, and some of the hair microscopically similar to
Marco. Thumbs down.
Yeah.
That's not a thing. You can't just compare hair and say this looks kind of the same. That's such bullshit.
No, this is not. There's a way to do, like, you know, like a lot of forensic science, like, there's a way that this could, like, point you in the direction of getting stronger evidence, but basically they're just saying, well, the hair was microscopically similar.
If it's not DNA, thumbs down, thumbs down, thumbs down.
And even DNA sometimes is not.
It's true.
Yeah, it's scary, actually. Dr. Lee determined that the hair belonged to a male Caucasian.
Oh, wow.
So, a white man.
Look, we're trying to say you're not all murderers, but you're not helping.
Your hair is not helping. The problem was that he didn't have a hair sample from any of the possible suspects to compare to the hair that he found on the evidence that was taken from the garage.
Also, this bullshit. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't really know. And this is weird. He also studied crime scene photographs and was allegedly able to provide a possible motive for Martha's murder.
Okay.
Yeah, there was, like, he said there was blood. I didn't understand this. He said there was blood smear on her body that indicated someone was trying to, like, sexually assault her, that it was a sexually motivated homicide, except that we know that there's, like, there wasn't evidence of a sexual assault. I mean, other than her pants were pulled down, which, you know,
I mean, I guess,
but like the blood smear, I don't know. They didn't really go into detail, and I didn't understand how that would be evidence of a motive.
I guess he is questioning whether or not there is not evidence of a sexual or attempted sexual assault. I guess maybe he's
which is fair given
he sees evidence of an attempt. It's an interpretation. It's not like a solid fact.
Leonard Levitt, an investigative reporter for the Long Island-based Newsday, covered the Moxley case starting in 1982 and says that there were no defensive wounds. Could that indicate that she knew her attacker? Possibly. Merely the fact that she was hit repeatedly with a golf club indicates some kind of rage, which they thought personalized the attack. Maybe it was a crime of passion. It seems unlikely this would be just what we know of these sorts of crimes, it seems unlikely that this would be a random act of violence.
It's a golf club from their fucking house.
Yeah.
So that means that, like, a sicko is driving down the street, sees Martha, decides, like, oh, I want to whatever her. I better go get a golf club. Like,
yeah.
Okay. Because if it is just some rando, you have to explain how they got the club. And yeah, so then exactly. It's like, did they just like leave that on their front porch or something? Like, even that seems weird.
Right. Because why would there was so many people in that house that night. Why would you like break into the garage and steal a golf club? It's not even like a good murder weapon.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense.
It seems like if you're willing to beat a woman over the head with a golf club, you could also, I don't know, just strangle her or something.
Right. Yeah. Why would you risk?
Right.
Breaking and entering to get a golf club. I don't know. So we're told
the time is again. There's just so many fucking people in that house.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
So who did it? You know.
So who did it? Because it. I don't know. It's
also there rough. Was four of them were verifiably not there at the time she was murdered. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. So we're told by Rubber Strack that time and time again, the trail led back to the Skakel family. Then in November of 1995, a full 20 years after the murder of Martha Moxley, Leonard Levitt reported in Newsday that Thomas and Michael Skakel had made startling admissions to the detectives. So at this point, both Thomas and Michael told investigators that they had lied to the police about their accounts of the nights of the murder. Thomas said that after 9:30, he went inside his house and then he went back out and spent another 20 minutes with Martha. He now claims that he and Martha engaged in a sexual act and then he left her at about 10 p.m. But even that like doesn't really line up because the nanny or the tutor said that Thomas didn't get back inside, or at least he didn't see him until 10:25. So even this story does not exactly line up. There is an update, and I can look at the Unsolved Mysteries wiki because it's detailed.
I did not look this up so that I could be surprised right now.
Oh, okay. So it's interesting. I don't know if you want to call this solved or not. I'll read the very detailed and lengthy Unsolved Mysteries wiki. So as a result of the broadcast, new witnesses came forward with information on the case. One witness was Gregory Coleman, a roommate of Michael's while they were at a military-style boarding school. In 1978, Michael was arrested for speeding, drunken driving, and fleeing police. He was sent to the school as a result. Coleman later recalled a conversation where Michael confessed to Martha's murder. He said that she had rejected his sexual advances, so he beat her with a golf club, which broke during the assault. He also commented, quote, I'm going to get away with murder. I'm a Kennedy. I mean, this was a wealthy family, so I think that's what he was referring to.
Also, no, you're not. Shut up.
Yeah, you are not.
I've never heard of you in my life.
No. Four other witnesses from the school also came forward claiming that Michael had either confessed to killing Martha or made basically suggestive statements to that effect. They even claimed that he had admitted to it during a group therapy session. During several of these sessions, he was confronted about the murder. On some occasions, he became upset and began to cry, saying that he did not know if he had did it. He also claimed that on the night of the murder, he was, quote, blind, drunk, and stumbling. He also told another resident at the school that he was drunk that night and was not sure if he killed Martha, but she did end up dead. So you would, I think at least in hindsight, no. He told them that he was sent there because his family believed he had killed her and wanted him to get away from investigators. Which sounds like rich person behavior. Send your kid to boarding school because he may have murdered someone or attacked someone.
Which, I don't know, if I was rich, I would not appreciate, because here I am sending my kid to boarding school because, I don't know, I don't like my kid. And then it's like, oh no, I sent him to boarding school with a murderer. Great.
I mean, yeah, there's multiple issues with this. Along with members
of the... What could possibly go wrong with them all trapped in this one...
Oh God.
What is the word I'm looking for? Suffocating environment where they never get to leave. What could possibly happen?
What could possibly go wrong? So along with members of the school, Michael made incriminating statements to others. In 1976, a barber recalled him mentioning that he wanted to kill someone.
A barber. He's telling the barber.
It seems like he had loose lips. When his sister Julie responded, "Shut up, Michael," his reply was, "Why not? I did it before." The family driver told police that in 1977, Michael had told them that he had done something, quote, really bad, and that he, quote, either had to kill himself or get out of the country, end quote. That same day, he also tried to commit suicide by jumping off of a bridge that they were driving on at the time. When he got back in the car, he said to the driver that, quote, "If you knew what I had done, you would never talk to me again." He also reportedly confessed to the murder while at a party.
The driver was like, "I only talk to you because I am paid to drive you around. I never want to speak to you whether you committed murder or not."
Yeah, he's certainly not paid enough for this, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Furthermore, investigators noted that when Michael reported a conversation for a book he planned to write about himself, he made other incriminating statements about his whereabouts on the night of Martha's murder.
Oh my God.
He recorded a conversation for a book he was going to write about himself. It was confusing.
This guy is just walking around confessing to grocers and barbers and everyone. And everybody's like, well, nothing's going to happen about that. Right?
I mean, like, really, he confessed to everyone he knew, it seems like. He apparently, in this recorded statement, said that he was masturbating above the same tree near which she was found.
What? Gross.
I know, it's disgusting. Investigators believe that he may have made this statement in order to explain his DNA being found on her body, although no DNA was actually found.
And the tree was like, "Leave me out of this. I had nothing to do with it."
Oh, that tree has seen some things.
Keep it in your pants.
He also stated that he was, quote, "worried about what I went to bed with that night."
What does that mean?
I have no idea. However,
the golf club. He was like petting the golf club, like, "Yes, my sweet, you will keep my secret." But then he tells everyone.
Unsolved Mysteries Wiki says it's not known if the what he referred to is what he did in the tree or what he may have done to Martha. Julie's friend, Andrea, who was at the Skakel home on the night of Martha's murder, claimed that Michael did not go with his brothers and cousins to the latter's home. She recalled that he had stayed behind and that Julie talked with him after the car left. Julie also told police that she believed she saw him walking on the property after the car left. One of the friends who was in the car with Martha and Michael that night stated that she was not sure if he had stayed behind or not. Several friends also told police that Michael was infatuated with Martha and wanted a relationship with her. They also claimed that he was jealous of her relationship with Thomas. Specifically, he seemed upset by the attention she gave Thomas on the night of the murder. Police theorized that he killed her after she rejected his sexual advances. And if what Thomas said was true about them having a sexual encounter, you know, was Michael jealous? Can only speculate. In June 1998, Connecticut Judge George Thim began an 18-month grand jury review of the evidence in the case. After taking testimony from 53 witnesses, Thim issued a report concluding that there was enough evidence to arrest Michael. Then
he's confessed to everyone in town!
I mean, it seems so. On January 19th, 2000, he was arrested and charged with Martha's murder. However, in August 2001, before his trial, one of the witnesses who heard him confess at the school, that was the first guy we talked about, Gregory Coleman, died of a drug overdose. Despite this,
suspicious.
In May 2002, he went on trial for the murder. On June 7th, he was convicted of first-degree murder. That's not where the story ends. So jurors believed that the circumstantial evidence, including Michael's various confessions, statements placing him at the murder scene, access to the murder weapon, and motive, were enough to prove his guilt. They also said that they did not believe his alibi witnesses and that his siblings and cousin were covering for him. He was given a sentence of 20 years to life. Which seems low, to be honest. In October 2007, a superior court judge denied his motion for a new trial. But in October 2013, in a dramatic new development, Michael was granted a new trial by a Connecticut judge who ruled that his attorney, Michael Sherman, had failed to adequately represent him at his trial.
He hadn't even brought that tree into court.
Well, I don't know. The tree under oath might have some not favorable things to say about Michael. The judge stated that the defense failed to give proper attention to detail in the case, failed to complete an energetic investigation, and did not have a coherent plan of defense. Prosecutors appealed the decision. Michael was released on bail. On December 31st, 2016, the Connecticut Supreme Court reinstated Michael's murder conviction, holding that Sherman provided a constitutionally adequate defense. However, he was not returned to prison. The defense asked the court... It's very complicated. The defense asked the court to review their decision. In May 2018, the Connecticut Supreme Court reversed its previous decision and overturned the murder conviction again. They stated that Sherman should have presented witnesses to support Michael's alibi. On October 30th, 2020...
What if there aren't any?
It sounds like there was. I don't know. The Unsolved Mysteries Wiki doesn't go into it, but it sounds like there was evidence that could have helped him and it was not presented because his attorney sucked. So October 30th, 2020, this thing has gone on forever. The state of Connecticut decided to not retry Michael, claiming that due to the deaths of several witnesses and the lack of new forensic evidence, they did not believe they would be able to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Poor fucking Martha.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems so implausible that the murderer wouldn't have been someone in the Skakel family.
It's probably also the dude that keeps saying he did it. I'm just going to go out on a limb. And
yeah.
I'm not saying he did it. I guess that hasn't been proven in a court of law at this moment. But if I had to...
It doesn't look great for Michael. Michael should probably stop going around telling everybody he killed Martha if he doesn't want to, I don't know, be put on trial for killing Martha. Like, it's wild. It's wild. Sorry for that super long update, but it was very twisty turny.
It's needed because those are so many developments and
And seriously, poor Martha. And like, I don't know. I feel like something tells me if this family wasn't rich, that this would have gone differently.
I don't think you can be poor and go around town being like, you know what, I killed a person, and just like nothing happens for years. Yeah. I don't think I could do that. I don't think most people could do that. I think you have to be pretty sheltered, even if you're not technically a Kennedy. Oh my God. I'm just imagining the scenario where like I'm the prison guard who's locking that guy up and he's like asking for shit and I keep going, yeah, okay, Kennedy.
Do you know who I am?
Yeah, all right, Kennedy. I'll get right on that, Kennedy. What's that? You don't like the food here? Oh, that's real sad. That's too bad. Ah, yeah, God, heartbreaking fucking case. Stay away from rich people. I think that's the moral.
They have such good advice.
They might be you with a golf club because you're not putting out. I don't know.
I mean, really? Oh, that one was wild.
Poor Martha. Just trying to be a girl, have a crush on a neighbor, you know?
Poor Martha. Poor Martha. Poor Martha's family. It just sucks.
It's fucking brutal.
There is a cold case file.
He just fucking left her there. You know? It's just sick. Yeah.
Okay. So there's a book called Murder in Greenwich by Mark Furman. There's also a cold case files about this.
Which Mark Furman? Is that police officer from the OJ trial, Mark Furman?
Oh, it is.
Weird. I'm not reading his book.
I was like, I knew that name sounded familiar and I Googled it. And as soon as he said that, I saw him in the OJ. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not reading that racist's book. No, thank you.
No. Okay. So maybe passing that one. There is a novel called A Season in Purgatory that's based on the case. And there's also a Cold Case Files episode, which is, I was going to try and get the episode. Oh, it's not on here. Google it. I don't know.
Wow, sad case. Okay, let's rate this one.
Okay, mysteriousness.
I feel like pretty mysterious. Is this woman being contacted from her dead dreams? Also, we don't know exactly what happened to Martha. We don't know what's up with this fucking family and their 7 kids.
It's not clear, I would say.
And we only got 3 mysteries and one of them was a lost love, but I think it still managed to be pretty mysterious. Thumbs up.
Yeah, I agree. Reenactments. Great.
Okay. I love those dream reenactments. They are all so goofy. They're hard to take seriously, but fortunately you don't have to, because it's just a silly, wholesome story of a grandpa coming and talking about French toast in your dreams, which is what more mysteries should be about.
I completely agree. They were good. The lost love one moved me to tears.
Yeah.
I thought the reenactments were really good.
I like the reenactments about the Green River Killer being eerily on vacation. I lied. We got 4 mysteries. I was forgetting about the Green River Killer for a second.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wasn't really about the Green River Killer.
I just like dismissed it out of hand, but it was in there.
I thought it was good. Thumbs in fashion, up. I feel like that hair alone
for Michelle.
Plus the episode.
Plus, in our lost love, we got some nice retro fashion.
True.
So, including a top I used to own. That was weird. So, thumbs up.
Thumbs up. And Robert Stack, I thought he did a good job.
I like Robert Stack talking about dreams
and standing by the Green River.
Yeah, he made a point to say that he had to go to Washington. I think he was a little bit pissed. He had to leave town. So, thumbs up for that too.
I thought it was great. And overall, on our Robert Stack rating,
I gotta say it's a pretty solid episode. I
liked it. I liked it a lot.
I'm gonna say 4.
Yeah, I think this is a solid 4. The Lost Love was good. The dream was great.
Spectacular. The idea of just accusing your brother of murder, but he didn't do it, that's pretty great. And then you get this really heartbreaking true crime story at the end to kind of, just really bum you out as the episode comes so close. So, yeah, I'd say that's a 4. Definitely agreed. Watch.
Agreed. This is one to watch.
And maybe show someone that dream segment. If you know someone who has seen a relative in their dreams, a deceased relative, speak to them. I would say,
Send us a better story.
We want to hear that story. Perhaps at gpodcast@gmail.com. Also, maybe like show them a segment and be like, was it like this? Did he ask about French toast? I'm going to do a found love real quick.
All right.
And you're not going to be interested. So you can just like tune out for a second. But I wanted to do a perfume recommendation. And I know that you're not into fragrances because you get migraines. So
yeah,
my apologies to all of the fragrance sensitive people out there. My heart goes out to you.
Thank you. It's hard being us.
Yeah, it does. It sucks.
I want to be able to wear fragrances.
I can tell that it sucks even without it, because I love perfume. And what's great about it is it gives me so much joy for so little effort, where I just have to press the button and then I go, it smells so good, right? So I really appreciate how little energy you have to put into it to get that dopamine of enjoyment back. But it usually comes with a major downside of a huge price tag. So I wanted to recommend a perfume that I think is excellent, smells expensive, but is quite cheap. Ooh. And that is, I think it's pronounced Odomer. It's a French brand, and they make a perfume called Atlantis. Now, the bottle I have says Atlantis Winter Cruise on it, but everywhere else just says Atlantis. I don't know. Anyway, to me, this smells like pine, vanilla, and snow.
Ooh.
The scent is listed as cedar, marine, and mint. Now, usually I hate like a wood scent. I'm not ever trying to like smell a tree personally. I'm not trying to smell like oud or like sandalwood, or I'm not into any of that stuff. But I think this is like so nice and refreshing, and I wear it all the fucking time. I just think it smells like very crisp and good, and like, yeah, it doesn't smell cheap. And it's, I wear this a lot in the winter. I have a 50 milliliter bottle that I got last year, and it's like half gone, which is amazing because I own way too much fucking perfume. So I wear this all the time. But this bottle, the 50 milliliter one, costs $22.
Wow, what a steal.
It really is. And that's why I'm recommending it. I don't like to recommend stuff that is pricey. I don't want people to feel like they're missing out on shit. But I feel like if you need a treat or you need a present or something, this is a very good buy because it doesn't look cheap, it doesn't smell cheap, but it's just very affordable. So I got this from the Metzer Apothecary in Chicago, which is like a fancy pharmacy, which is like the weirdest idea, but they have toiletries from Europe, basically. Oh. And they also have a website, for some reason not called that, called smallflower.com. Okay. And you can order it on there, or if you're in Chicago, you can just go pick it up. But and the 50 milliliter bottle is $22. The 100 milliliter bottle is only $28. Yeah, I just feel like it's a really good deal, and I just love... It's unisex. It's like very refreshing. I don't know. I think it's great. So that is my recommendation for this week.
Fantastic.
My found love.
Tolerate fragrances.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to flaunt that in your face like that. If you want to recommend like a very caffeinated product or I don't know, something like very physical that I can do, that would be fine.
I have a minor found love that's kind of like specifically for friend of the pod, Rochelle. I don't know if she's listening.
Okay. she better be.
If you're on a fitness journey, maybe in the new year or whatever, I have been doing a lot of walking since my back surgery. I try and walk as much as I can. And I came across, I think I saw this on TikTok, I'm not really sure, but an app called Fantasy Hike. It's free. It is basically, so I watched all the Lord of the Rings movies. My husband has read the series and is a big fan. But this is a Lord of the Rings app where you like walk, quote unquote, if you track your steps with some sort of fitness. I think you can maybe use your phone. I have an Apple Watch. But you can link the app to whatever like wearable device you have, and it will like take you along the trail. Honestly, like I downloaded it just because I was like, well, that's kind of fun and quirky. I've kept using it because it's just kind of like fun to see how far you've gone. Like it says that I've walked 65 miles in 23 days. And it will take me, I will get to Mount Doom at this rate on May 11th. There's also like, you can get little challengers within the app, and you can pick, I've chosen someone who walks at a normal speed and you're trying to like beat them to Mount Doom. It's also like kind of a pretty app. Like, I don't know, it's a weird thing to say, but it has like really pretty art with your like little guy on the screen that walks along the trail. It's like aesthetically pleasing. And I think if you are in, particularly if you are into Lord of the Rings and you like to walk, it's like a very niche group of people probably, but I think this might be something you would like. It's just kind of, I don't know, it adds a little bit of whimsy, I think, to something kind of mundane, like trying to walk every day, trying to meet your step goals, you know?
I'm trying to think of, I'm not a Lord of the Rings person. I once tried to read the books to impress a boy, and I couldn't get past the birthday party.
okay.
Because he goes into depth, like describing each of the like wrapping papers and stuff, and I was like, okay, like this is not for me. But I'm trying to think of like what journey I would rather go on, you know, like I need this but for a different thing.
I was thinking the same. Like I need it for like Game of Thrones, like something that I was really into that also included like a journey. I don't really know what that is, and it doesn't seem to exist. I did look. Because there's challenge apps out there. Some of them you have to pay for, which I'm not interested in. This one is like very simple, but also cute and fun. And I don't like that does not like seem to exist in other apps.
I need like the Animal Crossing version of this or something.
Oh, that's a good one. Or like even a real, like if there was an app that was like this, but like you were hiking the Appalachian Trail, like some sort of real life.
Oh yeah, that would be cool.
Trail.
Okay. No, I want Gonker.
What Gonker's app. Journey on the Appalachian Trail, yes. With a little dog. Yes. Oh my gosh! And you're trying you're trying to outrun Rob Lowe.
And then
instead
while
of trying
you're...
to beat someone to Mount Doom, you're trying to outrun Rob Lowe to the end of the Appalachian Trail.
Yes. And then if you're like walking around the mall or whatever, you have to go like Gonker the whole time. Okay. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to get our Patreon episode about the movie Dog Gone. For some reason, the movie's not just called Gonker. It's called Doggone. But
no, that's a jump scare in the movie. You found out the dog's name is Gonker.
Gonker. I would beat every step goal. If I could,
you had to outrun Rob Lowe to the end of the Appalachian Trail.
Yes.
Yes, it would be very motivating
for me and me alone. So someone make that.
Yeah. No, and this, and all I can offer you is the trail to Mount Doom.
Who wants to start the Kickstarter?
It could be a new app called, a new website called Kickstarter. Totally for a different crowd.
It's for keeping track of people who have Kickstarters. Like, what are they about? What are they doing? Okay, that brings everything to a close. I've already told you, you should sign up for our Patreon. You should definitely be borrowing people's phones to give us 5-star reviews, because that really motivates us to keep going. You should send us snacks. You can find an address on our website, perhapsdo.com. And I don't know, whatever all that other bullshit we're supposed to say at the end of this is.
Email us. Kind of on social media, but not really. You can join our Facebook groups. We do interact with people in there.
Yeah. And send us your spooky stories. Perhaps it's you, podcast@gmail.com. Has something happened to you? Have you had a direct contact in a dream? I definitely want to know about it.
That's something we want to hear about.
Yeah, the ghosts you've seen, the aliens you've seen, the time you met Robert Stack at the mall and you asked him to sign something and he huffed and puffed and didn't want to do it. We want to know about that.
Have you written into us and in your spooky story told us that you have more spooky stories, but you didn't send those?
Yes,
send those.
We're begging.
I don't know if these people are,
we're begging. Stop
listening. I don't know, but like,
we probably got boring, but look, we're trying, okay? We're hanging in there.
We're certainly doing our best.
And I know that's not good enough, but throw us a bone. Jesus. And that's it. Thanks, everybody. We will be back next fortnight.
Bye.
Bye. Keep barking.